Fakarın amayla! Fakarın amayla! Fakarın amayla! Fakarın amayla! Fakarın amayı kita tanıyana püyürün ayta taymata apukaylayla!
I have been looking forward to the After Dark all week.
That always worries me.
All week.
That always worries me. It thinks you've wound up with some incredible take that I have to slowly deflate.
It's not
explain.
It's not necessarily a take. It's just it's excitement.
You're excited.
I'm excited.
Big Kev. Look at you, Big Kev.
Shall we start
in
with
your flammable fucking shirt? Let me tell you.
Where do you want to start?
Went to high school with Big Kev's kids.
Yeah, right. Were they all always excited?
I can tell you are reproducible, but, you know, Big Kev's kids were a lot like Big Kev.
Did you like Courtney Barnett? Did you like this album?
Are we going to start with Courtney Barnett?
Yeah, all right.
I like Courtney Barnett's first album, which came out in 2015, which we reviewed on the podcast. And I listened to it this week. And I liked it more than I remembered because I thought, the first album was literally half decent. I thought about half of it was good. And it's a bit more than that. It's about 7 or 8 tracks. I remember really enjoying the kind of mid-90s UMI catchy kind of indie pop rock feel of it. And that very Australian voice. In her case, it's a very, very Melbourne voice. In that album in particular, because a lot of the songs are very placed in Melbourne. Like, Elevator Operator is explicitly about Melbourne, you know, the 96 tram and Swanston Street, and, you know, very placed. And Depression is a song about, you know, being priced out of the rental market in the inner suburbs of Melbourne and having to move further out. And it's almost got like a Paul Kelly narrative to it. And I think at her best, she's kind of got that. I'm not comparing to dudes to belittle her achievement. I'm sort of saying these are the fucking the state of the art of the art form in the 80s and 90s with guys like Paul Kelly and Tim Rogers, even Dave Faulkner. The way she writes these kind of whimsical lyrics that have this sort of even the rhyme structure reminds me a lot of Dave Faulkner from the Pooh Gurus. Obviously very strident Melbourne accent, which in fact is in a way. We meet her again in 2018, and she's definitely more downbeat, definitely a bit more bluesy, definitely more depressive, definitely angry with dudes, very, very, very fucking angry with dudes.
Considering the state of the world in 2018, that's not fucking surprising.
Considering the state of dudes, the absolute fucking state of men, I'm not fucking surprised. And there's songs like Nameless Faceless, which are, you know, entirely about how trash men are and how, you know, she gets verbal violence from them on the internet and then threats of actual violence when she's trying to walk home through the park and has to carry, you know, have her keys between her fingers kind of thing. There are still, there's still Melbourne references, you know, in the northwest, but nothing quite as very, very placed in Melbourne. Maybe fewer straightforward indie pop songs, a bit more wanderings off and sort of bluesy, twangy. In a way, it's a bit less like mid-90s UMI, more like a Tim Rogers solo album, if you like, from or a late 90s, early aughts sort of place. But that's what I thought about the album, to answer your question.
Did I like it?
Yes, I liked it.
Yeah, okay. I didn't like it. I didn't like this album. I found the vocal very...
Well, you only listened to it today.
Yeah, I did listen to it twice,
I'm going to air your laundry on this, but you only fucking listened... You started listening to this podcast, this album. You've listened to this album once.
Twice.
Three... Twice. 5 hours ago.
Yes. Your point being... Sometimes I only listen to the album once in a week. If I don't like it. This is the doc furiously typing into Google, can I get an alternative podcast host?
How good is silence?
The thing with silence is, with our podcast, you never know whether the silence is actual
fucking
disdain.
Fucking miserable, pissant, shithole, fucking Roadhouse's album.
I didn't have the reaction to this album that you did to
this
that.
This has intelligent commentary about the place of fucking lots of things.
How many times did you listen to Roadhouses?
Because it's a bad album by idiots.
I found her vocal
Sech.
Very...
Sess? Anyone called Cecil shouldn't be in the fucking music industry.
I found her vocal very Dylan-esque in her sort of... Not in her like lyricism, but just in the...
The fact she's this nasal Melbourne chick.
No, just the meter, I guess. The sort of pauses and the little hiccups of it. I don't know. And that's why I thought, because I've always thought some of the Tim Rogers solo stuff has that feel as well, that trying to be like a, you know, a bluesy singer-songwriter storyteller from the 70s in America.
I feel like it's more affectation with Tim because I feel like he's a very... I mean, it's clear Courtney's very insecure and self-conscious as well. I mean, literally one of her songs is, what is it, crippling self-doubt and a complete lack of self-confidence or worse to that effect. She's... Pills and booze
title.
Habit is anywhere as high as Tim's.
I really enjoy the music. I quite enjoy them... I really enjoy the music in this album, but I just I have a real dislike of that sort of stilted nasal vocal delivery.
Bizarre,
it was okay.
Women talking authentically in their own voice.
Sure, if that's where we want to go.
Bizarre hates Australian women talking authentically in their own voice.
The irony of you complaining about
someone else's nasal Australian accent is hilarious, though.
Yeah, I know. It's hypocritical. I'm aware of that. It was okay. I didn't hate it. It didn't grab me enough to go, hey, this was fucking awesome.
I have the same opinion of this album as I did of the 2015 album. I liked it. I mean, I'm in favor of it. It's not one of my favorite albums of the year, but I'm glad she exists. And some of the tracks on it are really cool. And some of the directions she's gone in, I'm interested in seeing more of.
I know two or three people I can recommend this album to that will absolutely love the shit out of it. So that's good. I really like musical diversity, and I like the fact that I can go, hey, I know you like this, so you'll probably like that. It's just. Speaking of albums,
it did remind me that there were actually some absolute gems on that first album, like some proper. If they'd been recorded and released at the heyday of this sort of music, which I think is probably fair to say is the middle '90s on Triple J sort of thing, would have been, you know, she would have been bigger than UMI, who had four consecutive number one albums or something. She could have been that.
Wrong time.
Not to say that she's not huge, but. You know, it feels like this is music from 20 years ago, which is why I like it, I think. Speaking of music from 20 years ago, nobody in Alien Weaponry was alive 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Or 18 years ago.
So I recommended this to a guy at work today who's a Kiwi and really into his metal. And I'm like, oh, what do you think of this album? And he's like, who? And I'm like, surely you being a Kiwi and into metal, you would have heard of this through the traps. He's like, no. And he went away, I listened to it and came back and went, oh my God, this album's so fucking good. These guys are like kids. I'm like, are they? He's like, yeah, they're like 16. Yeah. I was like,
no, not even that. Lead singer, 15.
That is fucking unbelievable.
His brother's 18. He's the drummer. And the guitarist is 15. They were playing gigs supporting big Kiwi metal bands like Devil's Kid. in their local area, which is Waipu up in up around Northland. Ironically, where my beer is from. I'm currently drinking Sawmill, which is also brewed in Waipu. That's up Whangarei way. They were, like, when they were 12 and 14, the three of them. So there's two brothers, one's 12, one's 14, and their other guy who they met at circus school. I get the feeling the parents are fairly arty, and the dad is apparently a hard-out metalhead. He's been, you know, in bands and stuff, so I think he's kind of the driving force behind them. But he can't play for them, and he can't generate the incredible force that exists behind these guys. I am so fucking impressed with these kids. Not only just the force of... I mean, they can play. Like, the chops are amazing. I mean, obviously in the studio you can do whatever you like, and Tom Larkin from Sheehead is on the fucking ones and twos. He did the production for this. So, admittedly, you know, you can make anything sound good. But the intelligence and the complexity and the political force behind this, behind the lyrics, behind the message, is just so impressive from a bunch of fucking tackers. It's so cool.
Okay, so you know me. I don't listen to lyrics. I don't. No, at least not on the first go. And I've listened to this album 20 times this week, maybe more. Just
try looking up the lyrics?
No, I haven't, and I will.
So their Bandcamp page actually has translations and explanations. I wish
you'd told me that really beforehand.
Because they reference a lot of, like, infamous and famous Māori versus the colonial power battles, and also like the Wreck of the Boyd, which is a horrific story about this revenge that was wreaked on this boat of white people for something that had been done to them by another bunch of white people, and it was incredibly grisly. I can't believe at no point anybody thought fucking Tareo would be the greatest language to do metal in.
It's fucking
because
awesome.
Because it fucking is. It's the most metal thing in the world.
Awesome.
The haka is the invention of metal, really.
Well, okay,
there's
so
nothing more metal than a haka.
You've hit on something that I think, you know, the All Blacks came up with their alternate haka, 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah, they actually got a specialist in to help them with it.
I propose that they have a third one, and instead of that bit at the start where they all sort of they all get hyped up. Well, instead of that, what they should do is every person in the crowd should get a Marshall speaker, and they should plug it in, and then they should start these guys doing the haka, because double kick drum behind the haka is just...
It's amazing.
It makes sense, doesn't it? It's just...
Track on this album, apart from the kind of the introduction, the I wish I had the track list in front of me. Falkeria, or I think it's something like that. It basically means introduction, if you like. Is a song about... it's basically the story of kind of a Māori version of the This Is Sparta story. It was like a couple of hundred Māori were trying to fight off 1,700 British, heavily armed British forces with artillery. And apparently at that time it was the largest ever artillery bombardment the British had ever set off, which was against this Māori pā in Tauranga. And the Māori won. And their the kids... great grandfather was one of the warriors who died defending the pa, the fort, the settlement from the colonies, from the colonial powers. So it feels incredibly real and incredibly grounded. The thing is that this album, they're very true to their ancestors, and I don't just mean the Tangata Whenua, they're Māori ancestors. They're also very true to the ancestors of the music, because what they're doing is incredibly on brand, particularly like that first real track of the album. feels like absolutely authentic 80s, 90s thrash metal. Double kicks and all the rest of it. It's just absolutely fucking nailed. There are some deviations from the album into more kind of, I won't say emo-y, but more kind of new metal-y, teenage-themed, you know, alienation and people are spending too much time on social media and all the rest of this sort of stuff. And that stuff doesn't work quite as well. Maybe they're better on the tone when they're basically doing Kapa Haka metal, but it's so impressive. And it reminded me of the fact that, I come back to this point, I don't understand why this hasn't been done before. I mean, the Scandinavians have this reputation for death metal and for black metal and all that sort of stuff. In terms of badasses, the Vikings were badasses, but they're nothing on the fucking Māori. These guys were built to have metal songs written about them. It's just fucking immense. And Tereo is such a... The phonetics, the kind of the percussive phonetics of Tereo are perfect for metal. Really, really impressed with this album. Do I actually like it and want to listen to it a lot? It's a slightly different question.
Oh, absolutely. I fucking love this album. I've thrashed this album. The only thing I haven't been able to do just because of time constraints this week is listen to it on headphones, and I'm savouring listening to this on headphones because this will be fucking awesome on headphones.
I've only listened to it on headphones, and it's a fucking lot.
I want to go out and buy the most expensive fucking pair of headphones that I can afford to listen to this album. This album is brilliant. I cannot... And look, if you listen to this podcast, metal of any description is not in my wheelhouse. This is not something that I would normally jump on top of. But this is just such a brilliantly put together... Like you said, the language works for this sort of music.
It's the invention of it that's almost more impressive than the music of it. It's the ideas. It's the whole, let's take... I mean, this is a much more interesting take on teenage rage and alienation, to put it in the context of the Māori experience in colonial New Zealand. It's just such a fascinating fucking take, as well as, and the fact that it works so well is so impressive.
And they're
fucking 15 years old.
Oh, that's just the cherry on top. Like, that just blows me away. Look, it's good that they had a good producer and not just some fucking backyard producer that would, you know.
This is such well performed.
Like, double kick drum is hard. I know. I've been friends with a couple of good drummers in my lifetime, both who've been good enough to use double kick drum properly. It's not an easy fucking skill. And to be able to play it like that is just fucking awesome. This is going to be hard to be topped for the best album this year. It's the album I've enjoyed the most easily.
I have to think about whether I like it because I'm so impressed by the achievement or whether I'm really enjoying the music of it.
There are a lot of
really fucking good metal songs on this. There are a few that are a little bit...
I'm not
a fan of whiny new metal. I think Holding My Breath is a good example of that kind of whiny new metal.
And that's probably what helps me, is because I've got no reference to it. I've got no, this is this type of metal song or this is the... I just think it's a fucking fantastically well put together album.
It's more that I listen to it and I go, I hate this song. Why do I hate this sort of song? Oh, that's right. It's this sort of song.
Yeah, I don't get that reference at all. But the thing I find with a lot of metal, and I think this comes back to the language and the voice that you have to use in that language, is that the Māori language is quite a musical language. It's not a Scandinavian...
Well, all the Polynesian languages, which are very closely related, they're all mostly phonetic, apart from certain vowel.
Like, even if you look at the introduction to this album, that could be the introduction to a Salmonella dub album. Do you know what I mean?
Like, well, you know, this is interesting. They had a soundtrack, a playlist on their Spotify page, and they said, like, here's some of the music that's influenced what we did. And there was a little bit of Kiwi dub in there, as well as a shitload of metal going from you know, old shit like Black Sabbath right through to more recent shit.
Yeah.
So
I think the fact that their lyricism and their vocal is a little bit more melodic, and it doesn't overpower the mix. The thing I find with some metal is the screaming sort of overpowers the guitars and the drums at certain points.
He's got such a good voice for a kid. And he's got so much depth.
It's amazing. This album.
He's doing such a good job.
Just fucking blew me away.
But and I have to say that what this reminded me of is weirdly is the one of the local high schools, what they call Kapahaka Group, which is like when they come out and do like traditional Māori song performances, like they'll do hakas or they'll do dancing and singing and stuff like that, and boys and girls. And there's a particular Kapahaka Group, which is a hybrid of the boys and the girls government high schools from South Dunedin. And their Kapahaka Group is really, really good. I've actually seen them open a couple of research conferences in the last couple of months, and they are, I've seen them literally, you'll see overseas delegates who are shook by what they've seen. Like they're just like, holy shit, what the fuck was that? These fucking teenage boys and girls have just put on this, you know, this room commanding performance and just ripped all the oxygen out the room and just blown people's fucking heads off. It's amazing. Amazing.
I made a joke before about them, you know, doing a haka version of this at a rugby game, but you could easily perform one of these songs and, you know, have the boys lined up to do the haka and have one of these songs, basically the last note falling out straight into the haka, and you wouldn't miss a beat. Like the attitude and the feel of it just seems to blend with metal so well. It's that challenge. It's that,
it's the original metal. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The aggression and as I said, it's a much better take on that, the usual kind of snotty teenage aggression. You know, the Fred Durst, I want to break stuff. You know, that kind of pissant. I need a pop filter of what I say. Fred Durst is a pissant. Pissant. That always struck me as kind of pathetic, shitty, dad won't let me borrow the car kind of teenage angst and rage. But this, it feels a lot more authentic in this sort of context, and justified too. Cause, the thing is that they've embedded, a lot of these songs are about things that happened in history. These kids know their fucking history. And that's why it's actually in its way. It's like it's a bit like Zach De La Rocha weaving the stories of the Zapatas and Zapatistas and the fucking, you know, this the colonial Spanish and Mexico and that sort of, he's weaving those stories into Rage Against the Machine. They're definitely using the same approach of using stories of the colony, you know, illegally stealing land from Māori chiefs, even though they were supposed to be protected under the Treaty of Waitangi. To kind of tell stories about, you know, modern relationships and modern circumstances. And the poise of 15-year-old. Anyway, we've made a point. This is a good album. You should listen to it. It's really impressive. I'm a fucking guest in this country. I'm trying to understand, you know, the relationship, like, you know, the relationship between Māori and the Crown is very, very different to the relationship between Australian Indigenous people and the Commonwealth of Australia, which is the format that I grew up in, and we were told a lot of bunch of bullshit that we've subsequently had to unlearn as we've gotten older. But it's a totally different sort of circumstance. They've had a lot of the same kind of, you know, inequality and deprivation and that sort of stuff as an end result. But it's a very different sort of story, and it's a very interesting story to dig into.
I don't think I've ever been so keen for an episode of this podcast to post, because I just want to fucking evangelize the fuck out of this album, and I don't want to do it until we posted the episode.
No, I think we should do it anyway. We should say, look, we're going to break format here, folks. Normally we save our takes for the episode, but listen to this fucking album. Even if you don't like metal, it's more than just, you know, more than just fucking All Black Flankers and Once Were Warriors. These kids have got a lot to tell, a lot to say. I can say in my very awkward white guy visiting Australian kind of way.
Mm. Well, the funny thing is this bent this album bent everything around the way I listened to music this week.
Oh, so Steph carried the gravity around the whole.
Yeah, because I actually think I would have enjoyed the Dirt album a lot more. But I just
I think the important thing is to point out is that, I mean, Alice in Chains were promoted as a grunge band in period. This is a metal album.
Yeah. Metal. Yep. That's right.
It's not anything. I mean, it's a depressed.
It's a slow metal album, isn't it?
And it fucking Soundgarden of the period, like Soundgarden of kind of 1989, 1991. This is what they sounded like too. So it was. They kind of got dragged along with the Nirvana Pearl Jam thing, but they weren't. I mean, particularly Alice in Chains, they were never really a. I mean, grunge was a broad tent, but they were a metal band. This is a metal album. This album is all about two things. One, I want to die. Two, heroin is tops. And those are the two overarching themes of the album. And the thing is that, I know you sort of said, you know, you revel in the melancholy or whatever, but the lyrics are very depressing. I kind of feel for anything out of Seattle for kind of the period 1990 to 94, the lyrics are a wash. You just don't even, absorb them on any kind of level other than, oh, you're sad.
Yep.
Okay. You know, we know you're going to be singing about how you want to top yourself or heroin is really tasty. You kind of have to kind of let that be a wash and not dig too deeply into it because otherwise you'd never leave the house.
I think this is a pretty good album. It is quite depressing. It's quite a drag. Rooster just gleams out of this album like it is just such a good song. Nah, I like Sick Man.
He ain't gonna die!
Godsmack, but Rooster is just... It's like the perfect expression of what they were trying to do.
It is quite hair metal in the album. Places too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough. The problem I had with listening to this... I listened to this album twice this week. I was really keen to sort of dig into it. I kept getting drawn back to the other one. I'd listen to something like even today I really wanted to listen to that Triple J soundtrack, you know, the Baz Luhrmann J-Files, because I'm quite interested in that. I put it on for 3 minutes and I went, I'm going back to the other one.
I just want to go listen to it again. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Them Bones and Damn That River a very kind of, you know, I think about them more in the less of the context of, say, Nevermind, and more in the context of, say, Metallica's Black Album.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of more where they are, particularly like those Them Bones and Damn That River is the opening tracks. And when you look at the track listings, you think, gee, I wonder if this is an album about drugs. Sick Man, Junkhead, Godsmack. Yeah. I mean, it's literally how much fucking drugs. All Dirt. The drugs. Lane Staley went on to die of a drug overdose in 2002.
Yeah.
And Jerry Cantrell keeps trying to keep the band alive, and it never works. You shouldn't do that. See also Stone Temple Pilots. Actually, speaking of Stone Temple Pilots, they, of course, released Core the year that this came out. And some of the instrumentation on this feels a hell of a lot like Core. And I understand the place that album holds in your personal fucking headcanon. Because I know you always come back to that as a reference point for all of grunge, even though some people would say they were late arrivers and they were kind of, well, for marketing purposes, were kind of thrown in with the Seattle bands, even though, again, they were more of an alternative metal band at that point of their career.
But I think...
In the same way you could say Alice in Chains were.
It was easy for the music media of the time to go, oh, this is grunge, you know, grunge is this, if you're playing guitars...
Or even more the fucking record labels who thought, fuck, we need more of that, we need to make more money, we've seen what... With Nevermind, we need more of them.
And these guys...
Because the days where that shit still happened.
These guys in Stone Temple Pilots went, we're a grunge band, give us a record contract, or fucking whatever we have to do.
From Seattle, well, it sure beats raising cattle, yeah, thank you, Weird Al. But this is the thing, I mean, it all seemed very bleak and horrible and all the rest of it, but you think that only 15 minutes before, people had been singing about, you know, how she was my cherry pie.
That's right.
Literally 15 minutes ago. We Motley Crue are probably still side of stage. Talking about having their hearts kick-started.
It would have made some very interesting festival lineups back then. Like,
it was a fucking weird time. And you had Guns N' Roses who were kind of...
Yeah, like the Bridge. Like, I mean, they were the Bridge.
Get a lot of shit, but in a way they were kind of a hype. They were not a hybrid act, but they set the tone because they were singing a lot of their songs were depressing and about being heavily into drugs, and a lot of the lyrical content. If you just had like a depressed Axl, you'd get the lyrics on this album.
Yeah.
And in fact, at one point I was thinking if you took Kurt Cobain's vocal and you put it on Stone Pilots Core, you'd get Alice in Chains.
Yeah, okay.
Just because of the sound of Layne Staley's vocal.
Yeah.
It does sound a little bit like a slightly more southern Kurt Cobain. The guitar structure sounded a lot like Core, Stone Temple Pilots, which, weirdly enough, is not what they sounded like for the rest of their career.
No. No, it was sort of a moment in time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
All right. I got two very different... as I am the resident grime booster of this podcast, I'm going to go with a female grime artist called Miss Banks, and her album is called The Coldest Winter Ever.
I think I'm having that at the moment.
It's quite possible. I'm still have a pair of a short sleeve shirt on, so... But I do have a fire going.
I have a hoodie. That's all I ever need.
Yeah, that's...
I now have almost as many hoodies as t-shirts, I think.
Which is not a bad state to be in. I love hoodies.
No, the hoodies are the best. Hoodies are a cuddle. They're the best. I couldn't live in a place that doesn't let you wear hoodies like for at least 6 months of the year.
I was going to say, like, I wear hoodies, but they're sort of more like aspirational hoodies. It's like you put them on and then you get hot and then you have to take them off.
You got to kind of cut vents in your armpits.
Yeah, that's right. The second album is an album that I've been really looking forward to ever since I heard that it was being released this year, and it's the Presets album. Will it be a legacy act album?
Have we done a Presets? I know we've done them as a classic. I can't remember whether we've
had a
new album recently.
It's been a while between drinks.
High Viz High Tea, but that was by Friends of Rome. Speaking of not particularly successful legacy albums.
Trying to think. No, Pacifica Deluxe was their second album, was 2013. So that's too long ago.
We definitely did Apocalypso.
Yep.
I've got a feeling I know what this album's going to sound like, but let's do the experiment.
Hopefully it sounds like the Presets, but...
Well, it's going to sound like the Presets because everything the Presets do sounds like the Presets.
Yeah, their second album was not as compelling as their first album. Will they find something else or will they just keep going downwards?
They'll just keep doing club bangers. But, I mean, fuck, that's what the Prodigy did. And they happen to do it well.
The Chemical Brothers have done it well for 30 years. You know, that last album was every bit as good as any of their early albums. So it can be done. I think it can be done. Actually, I actually think it can be done easier in electronic music than it can in lyrics because... In more lyrically driven music, because you've got to have the lyrics and the sort of feel to drag it through. I don't know whether you need that as much.
Although it is harder to do in a world where sample clearance becomes harder every day. I like that somebody posted on Twitter the idea that it's to have the purge, but what it means is that all sample clearance is legal for the day, so you can just make whatever fucking beats you want. I'm in favor of that.
That's called YouTube. I listen to a lot of like
that's called 80s hip hop, I think.
I listen to a lot of there's quite a few good trip hop sort of mixes and mashups and stuff on YouTube, and every now and again, I'll be listening to something that's really, you know, just really kicking it. I'm really enjoying, like, stuff to listen to while I'm having dinner, basically, or making dinner. And then all of a sudden, there'll be like 7 minutes of silence. And I'm like, what the fuck's happened to my, oh, you know, they get the DCMA, whatever, takedown. This track has been removed. Like, YouTube just literally cuts out huge sections of these mixes when whatever record company finds out that you've been using their samples. So it's quite amusing. All right, what do you got for me for a classic?
Baby, here we come. We're going to step on you. The Hoodoo Gurus are now on Spotify after many, 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 many months of not being on Spotify. And the Hoodoo Gurus were were a brilliant band of the 80s and the mid 90s in Australia. One of the few good things of the 80s in music in Australia. And they've had a lot of really good albums, so the question is, which one do you pick as a classic? But the one I would pick would be their album from 1994 called Crank, because it was around the time that I was really listening to the radio a lot. This was before Triple J came our way in the part of the country that I grew up in. And a hell of a lot of the tracks of this album got released as singles, and they're all fucking bangers. And I became a Gurus fan in the late 90s. And then when they reformed to play, I think it was Homebake in 2001, I was really keen to see them. And they've always been a fucking amazing live band. Underrated, loud live band, though. And you'd think, oh, well, they, you know, come any time and fucking, you know, little fucking 80s pop songs. No, huge Marshall stack. And they fucking shred. And the loudest gig I've ever been to was the Hoodoo Gurus at a regional golf club in 2005. My ears have never recovered. Spiderbait were their support act. And Spiderbait are fucking loud. The Gurus came up and went, no, we're going to be louder. So that's what happened. And now I can't hear.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave.
Which is, because they had... I guess a little bit like Hunters, except that I didn't come into them that way. But Hunters are always like a little sort of 80s poppy band, but had a...
Yeah, although they took themselves much more seriously.
Yeah, the Gurus always had that, like, sense of fun, yeah. You
know, yeah, they've always written sort of funny pop songs, really.
They were sort of... Hoodoo Gurus were like in between... what's Shirl's band? I can never remember the name of it.
Skyhooks.
They're sort of like in between Skyhooks and Hunters, weren't they? They were sort of not quite as silly as Skyhooks, but not as serious as Hunters.
That's probably fair. I mean, they wrote songs about. I mean, their first hit was Leilani, which was a song about a guy whose girlfriend was going to be sacrificed to a volcano, and he was really bummed out about it, which is fine. but the album we're picking is Crank from 1994, which, of course, the lead single of Crank was The Right Time, which I think is one of the greatest punk rock songs ever written. It wasn't written as a punk rock song, but it has the feel of a punk rock song. It feels like it has about 2.5 chords, and it's angry, and it's obnoxious, and that was the song that made me fall in love with the Hoodoo Gurus. And then I discovered, oh shit, they were always a garage punk band. They just pretended to be a 80s novelty song band for most of the 80s. But that's really where they came from. People who remember when I talked to Albion Love Den when we reviewed The Saints. The Gurus came out of the same group of bands that produced the Radio Birdman and The Saints in the late 70s. They were in some of the bands that are associated with those acts. The kind of the scene that developed around that. So... it's not that surprising that some of their best stuff actually has that quality to it.
That'll be fun.
Crank is on there. Again, it's one of those things where they've thrown all the B-sides and the spare stuff on there. So the album itself stops at about track 13 or something. But a lot of the bonus content is actually really good, because a lot of it's also been used on other Guru stuff. So it's all worth listening to. But we'll talk more about them next week.
Yep. All right, Doc. Good week. Glad you picked that album. That's a cracker. I don't know if it's going to get topped this year, but we will see.
We'll see. It'll depend. As I said, for me, it'll depend on how the... I mean, the high points are fucking stratospheric. It'll just depend on how the whole package develops. But as an achievement, it's
amazing.
It's really, really fucking impressive.
Cool. All right, Doc. I'll catch you on the flip side.
Sure. That's a good one, isn't it? I think it's like, I think I said last week, people are not in any way related except for the fact that I happen to follow them and other people and saying, oh, the alien weaponry. Oh, fuck, this is really good. And Kaitangata, which is the song, which is literally about, we're going to kill you and eat you. That was the one with the film clip that's quite messy because it's about killing and eating people. I think we're going to be embarrassed by how giddily we raved about this. We sound like 15-year-olds. I sound like a fucking 15-year-old. But it was... they were like, you guys are embarrassing, fucking the kids. It's funny, when I was up in Northland at the start of the year, we stayed up in the Bay of Islands, which is up in Northland, which is where these guys are from. And it's a very different place from the part of New Zealand I live in, which is the realities of Māori settlement and the battles between Māori and the colonial powers are much more, even the evidence is much more real up there, because there's always the evidence, you know, here's a site of an ancient battle, here's a site of a place where the Brits put up a flagpole and Māori burned it down because the Brits were being cunts about, you know, they'd signed this treaty and weren't honouring it, which is basically the story of all Māori colonial relationships, is they signed a contract in good, the treaty in good faith, and then the Crown basically fucked them on it for hundreds of years. That's kind of the subtext to everything. But it's very, if you're up there, it feels very real in a way. I mean, all the place names are Māori, whereas down here it's all fucking Anglo as shit. So it almost feels like a different country. I mean, it's same weather and same scenery. He hung up on me. What a cunt.